Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our program for this 18th day of April. It is Thursday. It is 14 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. And whether you want to believe it or not, we come in peace. We're not trying to scare you or anything, but we'll see how we do. We have a fantastic panel this morning, and I'm very excited to introduce them to you. Let me first remind you that you can be a part of the program. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we're very excited that you get to be a part of our program. It's important for us, and we really like to hear what you have to say. I also want to mention that tomorrow we're having a live broadcast from the Linda. We are doing this program from 9 to 11, the panel portion of the program, which, by the way, well, I'll get to that in a second. We're going to follow it with a really cool Earth Day special. But from 9 to 11, we will be on the air live from the Linda with an incredible list of panelists. Let me just introduce them to you or list them for you. Judith Enck, Vera Carius-Kelly, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Libby Post, Nick Rangel, Sarah Rogerson. Those are all in alphabetic order. And I left Judy for last because Judy's going to be on the show. So, at which, a couple of things. First of all, thank God. Second of all, it's the third time you've been on this week?
It is. You know, I was away for a couple of weeks, so I feel like I'm making up for last time.
Well, I mean, it's not like this is not your issue. This is our issue of, oh, let's get Judy back on. Oh, I want Judy on. So anyway, it should be a lot of fun. All you have to do is go to WAMC. It will be a lot of fun. I have no doubt. We'll meet about 8:30 or so. The doors will open. There's breakfast. Sit down, grab a chair, and come and enjoy the conversation for 2 hours. It should be an awful lot of fun that we're going to have tomorrow. Wide range of issues, lots to talk about, cool things, and we hope that you can be a part of the broadcast with us.
Joe, I have to congratulate you. The Marvel Universe for years has been threatening to get a group of female superheroes together for a film, and you beat them to it. I've been at those events in the past, and that'll be amazing tomorrow.
Well,
congratulations!
And we're missing some. I just want to say that we had a problem. We basically it's good for six. Then we pushed it to seven, and we left some people out, and Teresa being one of them, unfortunately. And it was really for no other reason than who was on the schedule that week, because you weren't at that time on the schedule for the week, but also that we so we didn't get to everybody. If we had all of our female panelists on, we wouldn't have room for an audience. So we don't have room on that stage. But I'm very pleased that we have who we have.
Well, plus, Joe, you always have to have a few superheroes in reserve.
That's right.
And but it's a really interesting mix of people, you know, interesting backgrounds, come at issues different ways. So.
Well, we tried to think of it and think about it a little bit and see how it will go. And
should be great.
No special, really special topic tomorrow, except for we're going to I'm going to poll the panelists and ask them what they would like to talk about, and it will be basically generated from the stories that they want to discuss and things they would like to discuss, and also of course the audience of what they bring up to our incredible panel. If you go to WAMC.org, you can get your tickets online, WAMC.org, and just go to the Donate Now button in the pull-down menu, and the tickets are there. Or, even quicker, you can just call 1-800-323-9262 and get your tickets that way. It's a $75 donation to WAMC. It's a fundraiser. We started this during the fun drive, and now we have some tickets left. So we are excited and hope that you will be a part of the proceedings. Let me introduce the group to you this morning. We welcome public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Teresa, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Delighted to be here. Doing all right.
Wonderful to have you here.
National Exercise Day, so, you know, everybody get up and do something. Walk to get donuts.
No. Walk to get donuts. That's good. Yeah, walk to get donuts. That is good. Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, is here. Hi, Judy.
Good morning.
So good to have you back. Judy's not only going to be doing our show, she's not only going to be doing the show tomorrow, but she's also going to be doing the media project. So we certainly, I was going to say get our money's worth, but she works for free, so, you know.
You do get your money's worth.
Yeah,
then.
We get our money's worth. That's right. Mark Whitman is here, Wall Street investment banker, dear friend. Thank you so much for being with us. Always good to have you on the program.
It's great to be here.
Thank you very much. All right. Let's talk about what's in the news and what's on the line today. We welcome, again, your thoughts, panel at WAMC.org. Okay. A lot of places that we can begin, but let's talk foreign aid and Speaker Johnson moving on. This is the headline in the Washington Post. Speaker Johnson moves on foreign aid, possibly triggering vote to oust him. The speaker has introduced a complex five-part plan requiring separate floor votes on Israel and Ukraine, as well as standalone legislation. And it's a separate vote on border security that was intensified to mollify hard right members. Two things. One, I love the word mollify. Two, it isn't easy to mollify the Republican the hard right members in the House of Representatives. So instead of this plan that he floated this week, Johnson now intends to try to pass five bills, not four. One each for aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Indo-Pacific allies, as well as GOP wish list of foreign policy priorities, and a fifth standalone bill to address widespread Republican demands to strengthen the southern U.S. border. GOP leadership announced that the House would stay in session until Saturday to consider the bills. The new approach is risky and is already blowing up on the speaker, whose six-month hold on the gavel is being threatened by a promise by Marjorie Taylor Greene to invoke, quote, motion to vacate, to topple Johnson, if he puts Ukraine aid on the floor, something to which many hard-right Republicans object. Teresa.
This is ridiculous. I'm sorry.
We'll start with that.
First of all, the Congress needed to pass a package of aid for Israel, humanitarian aid for Gaza, China, Philippines, the whole package a long, long time ago. But these Republicans said, well, no, you can't do that without border security. So they spent months working to put together a border security package with Republicans, Senator Lankford and others. It was all set to go to the floor. Then former President Trump signals, oh, no, 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 we don't want that. And so blows up the border security bill. So then the Senate passes a package. Bottom line is the House should just take up the Senate's package and pass it. There are enough votes in the House to do that. The world is watching. The world is on fire. Ukraine needs the funding. Israel needs the funding. As best I know, there isn't the humanitarian funding for Gaza in this package. And now they've added a TikTok provision. There are the votes in the House to do this. Put it on the floor. Let's see what Marjorie Taylor Greene does or doesn't do. But the security of the U.S. and the security of the world should not rest in her hands. And it's really a problem.
At any point,
on any issue. And if these members of Congress didn't learn enough by what, went on in the Middle East in the last few weeks, they are not doing their jobs. Just bring a package to the floor for a vote. The wisest, best, most expedient thing to do is bring the package that's already passed the Senate so that they can get it to the president's desk. The Secretary of Defense was testifying yesterday. about the budget, the next budget, which, by the way, they kept asking him, what's the most important thing we could or should be doing? He said, get us budget bills done on time. But he also talked about how critical the need is for this funding for Ukraine. And it's well past due. And he reminded people the vast majority of the funding is going to businesses in the United States. And I heard a Republican talking about that the other day as if it was news. In any case, do their jobs, get it done.
It is something that we've been discussing most of this week, which is the fact that with Israel and our assistance when the Iranian drone attack happened, that there was an article earlier that we were referring to and had referenced a couple of times regarding Ukraine feeling alone.
Absolutely.
And so we've discussed this a lot this week, and yet it still continues to be an issue for many House Republicans as to, well, for a better term, coughing up cash for Ukraine, which is and the reasoning on it, to me, really isn't all that apparent. I don't even know what exactly the reasoning is, other than just it seems to be something that can hold up the president and hold up the speaker, and that's difficult to. I mean, if that's your only goal, I don't know what you do.
You know, people are painting this as Mike Johnson's the night Mike Johnson became Speaker. You know, that he stepped forward, and he realized the potential and his responsibilities. He's referring to Reagan. He's talking about how great America is. I say that all that is hogwash. I think he went to Mar-a-Lago. He talked to Trump. They struck some deal. They've realized the political calculation if the Congress goes on another, they need to find another leader. They probably can't even find anybody within that 400-plus member body that would want to do it. And Trump told them, go ahead, we've got your back. Yeah, Marjorie might be out, and you know, but the Democrats will step forward and save your speakership. I totally support funding for Ukraine, and I am incredibly upset that the Republicans have not articulated a good reason why they are against funding for Ukraine. But the idea that Mike Johnson has finally found a spine, I find ridiculous.
But did he really say, I mean, Trump may have said to Johnson, go ahead, we've got you back. But then what's he saying to Marjorie Taylor Greene? Because you know she's talking to him. So
He's saying, Marjorie, you can be Marjorie.
We need to hear the voices of the reasonable here, the members of Congress who understand the global implications of what's going on. And if you ever want evidence about why Donald Trump should not be president again, all this machinations and equivocations that are putting our country and the world at risk is yet another example of it. Sorry to interrupt you. Trump said something for 5 minutes down in Mar-a-Lago. What were they there to talk about? They were there to talk about, you know, disruption of the upcoming election in the U.S., right? And then maybe he says, go ahead. But Marjorie Taylor Greene's not doing this on her own. And why don't they diminish her power? Raise up some of the voices of the common sense Republican members of Congress who understand the short and long-term implications of their inaction.
Marjorie Taylor Greene is appealing to the base. She's solidifying the base that, yep, we hear you on Ukraine. We support you on Ukraine. They're doing two things at once.
Because you know the moment, and I want to get to Mark here, but and you know the moment that those individuals come forward, if they were to come forward, that the first thing you're going to hear out of former President Trump's mouth is "rhino," Republican in name only.
So, you know.
Well, I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying I think that's what they're dealing with and trying to those Republican House members who need to get elected this fall are thinking about their futures as well.
Primary season's over. You know,
You're tough.
Just
all right.
Go do your job. Go do your job. Primary season's over.
Mark, we have 2 minutes, although if you need more time, we can do it on the other end of the break.
All right, well, just give me a warning, but you talked about the first three aid bills for the countries at war under threat, and then the other two sort of Republican bills. It reminds me of the Star Wars films. The first three movies were clearly about good and evil and the triumph of the galactic force promoting humanity in the end. The next two movies, frankly, were cringeworthy and tinged with racism and xenophobia. So there we are. If you take those five bills in order, they bear an interesting resemblance. The costs of – look, I'm inclined to applaud Johnson for his latest action, which is trying to get these through. I think you have to realize that the costs have been severe. The Ukrainians, because of their dwindling military inventories, particularly in terms of missiles,
right.
In terms of air protection, have probably lost civilians to Russian attacks while we've been dithering.
In the last 24 hours.
Yeah. And despite what Tom Cotton and some other people who I think view this very foolishly have said, much of our deterrence with respect to China and Taiwan is irreparably harmed. There is the part of that deterrence historically rested on the possibility that the United States would actually enter a shooting war between China and Taiwan. The United States has proven itself incapable of even boxing up arms and sending them over to the Ukraine. Having seen that, China is going to make the right conclusion, which is until our politics dramatically change, we will not have the stomach to get involved directly in Taiwan. So we've already baked that cake. And I'll get to some of the other issues in a moment.
We will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we'll continue on this and bring other things to the table. First, the news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Quick personal note. I've been getting a couple of letters this morning that have been coming in, people that are concerned about how I sound on the air this morning and are worried. I'm fine. Thank you very much for asking. I appreciate it. If you've been listening over the last couple of weeks, I'm dealing with kidney stones and kidney surgery. And it is very painful. And sometimes I'm better at – there are moments where I could get through like now, and then there's other moments where your breath is just taken away. And you're like, And so I decided a while ago that I could be miserable at home or I could be miserable here. And, hey, why not inflict this on all of you? Why should I be alone? And the other thing, too, is why I think over the last day or two things may sound a little worse is that I here's the fun little thing. So I'm having surgery next week. And the days before surgery, they make you they make you stop taking all of the medicine that you were taking to help you feel better. And so that's the problem. So I apologize. I do thank you very much for the concern. I'm fine. I'm driving down here. Oh, and by the way, I checked out with my doctor and surgeon, asked them if it was okay. They said fine. So I know I'm not sounding my best. Thank you for putting up with it. And hopefully by the end of next week, all of the hardware that is in me will be out of me, and all of the gravel that is there will be taken out as well. But again, thank you very much for the nice remarks. It does mean a lot to me. Nothing quite gets your day off of. You sound terrible. Mark.
So, Joe, I had started by saying that I think Johnson deserves some credit, but first we have to assess the costs of the delay. I'd also caution Johnson and the isolationists amongst the Republicans. I tell them a little story. I went through the FDR Museum over the weekend, and you look at the pictures of the America First Committee meetings, and just to clue the Republicans in, those guys are now, in retrospect, considered the bad guys. So a little historical perspective is not going to be kind. The issue about U.S. expenditures into Ukraine, I think this thing about, oh, we produce the arms here, so this really benefits America is a little bit of a stretch. Actually, it's a weak economic argument. But I think there's even a better argument, which is this is an extraordinarily inexpensive investment in the security of our allies and our own and our own country. And I think that's the big miss here, not the fact that some people are employed building them here, but rather the fact that this is just such a cheap way to denigrate the Russians, to burnish our credentials as a country and the credentials of our alliance. That's really where I think we should focus. Johnson's come to a point where he's basically had to call the question on his leadership. He's basically said, if I put this forward, I might lose my speakership and I'm going to roll the dice. And I think he's to be congratulated for that. It sounds to me like he's already been working in league with the Democrats to get this done. I heard Nancy Pelosi last night on CNN praising him for a clever parliamentary move. So I suspect they sent her out as opposed to obviously Hakeem Jeffries would be a more explicit endorsement. But I think there's something afoot, and congratulations to them if they are working this out. I think the forces that Marjorie Taylor Greene represents need to be understood fully. She is now reportedly espousing a couple of theories, one of which is that Ukraine is rife with Nazis. The other was this quote that they're murdering priests and they're anti-Catholic in the Ukraine. She literally is repeating talking points that it's, at least in the reports I read, that they could trace back to Russian troll farms and Russian propaganda. I just wonder the intelligence of someone like that and the rest of the Berserker Conference. But look, I think it's clear the United States has come to a point where we need to get on with supporting our allies around the world. Johnson's calling the question. I hope he survives, but I think it's far more important that the Ukrainians and our other allies benefit from this. And if he's a casualty, then so be it, and I'll applaud him a bit for trading his job for Western values throughout the world.
But it's highly unlikely that if she, you know, I think it's true that they need to call the question, but I think that it's highly unlikely that he's going to lose his speakership, because I think enough House Republicans do not want to go to the chaos of another 15 rounds of votes. Who's waiting in the wings to take the job? Who's going to take the job? And they feel like he's doing a good enough job. The majority of the majority do. And I think that because he has such a close majority, if he moves these bills, there will be enough Democrats who come over and vote for him. Maybe the others vote present. Maybe they vote for him en masse. I don't know. That'll be a strategy that they'll work out. But I don't think that the changing the House leadership now is in anyone's interest, and there'll be a way to work that out. So it likely doesn't happen. I could be wrong, but I do think that, again, the rest of the world is watching. These are very precarious times. This is signaling weakness. And I don't think Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing this on her own. I think she's doing it in close conversation with Trump. She talks all the time about how she talks all the time with Trump. I don't think if he said don't do this, I don't think she would be doing it. And I think that's a reminder of his calculations and of whose interest he's working for. I mean, for him, it's all a political calculation. Can you weaken Biden to strengthen him? But we shouldn't be worrying about weakening Biden or Trump. We should be worried about weakening the U.S. position in the world. And we should be worrying about what's happening in the Ukraine, what's happening to people in Gaza, what's happening with our, you know, in Israel. That should be the focus of Trump.
We have letters, and we welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll get to as many as we can before we have to take a break, and then we'll come back, get to more letters, and then move on to other subjects. Christopher says, I disagree with Mark about America not protecting Taiwan. TSMC creates, TSMC stands for?
It's the big microchip company that now produces the vast bulk of the high-capability microchips.
Do not use abbreviations. We don't know what you're talking about.
And they're based
in Taiwan. They've been historically considered, there's a word in Mandarin that means a mountain that can be used as defense, and they've effectively referred to that company as the natural defense of Taiwan historically. Go ahead, Joe.
TSMC creates the vast majority of semiconductors that we use in our daily lives and industries. When the chips are down, we will defend that, at least until we have the manufacturing capabilities stateside.
I don't think that's right. I think if you can't get the Americans to box up rifles and send them to Ukraine, there's no way that you're going to get Americans to suffer what are going to be catastrophic military costs if we take the Chinese on directly. But the letter writer is to be congratulated for their subtlety, because what they realize is that the United States now, part of this CHIPS Act, is basically the government and industry saying, boy, it sure stunk to have those businesses stuck in Russia when we decided we weren't going to do business with them anymore. We need to get this high-capacity microchip production out of Taiwan as quickly as we can.
Into the U.S.
Into the United States, and some of our allies are doing the same thing. As to whether or not, in a way, I think actually the point's moot, because I think the next 4 or 5 years, China's learned enough from the Ukraine, and they've got enough work to do with their own military capabilities that they wouldn't pull the trigger, or they wouldn't launch an attack for a while anyway. Time's on their side, particularly, by the way, when you think about it from the Chinese political perspective. They think in much, much longer horizons than we do. But I think we've answered the question for the Chinese for the foreseeable future as to whether or not we'd get involved. And the answer is not under our current political conditions, would we?
But I do think it's important that the Biden administration is taking the leadership on growing at as fast as pace as possible the chips manufacturing in the U.S. and reshoring that. And I think Senator Schumer should also be applauded for his leadership in that issue.
By the way, it's Taiwanese Semiconductor Manufacturing Company.
Excellent. Thank you.
Good letter. Thank you for sending it.
Yeah, it's a great letter.
We go to Mary Beth. Mike Johnson needs to do his job and bring the full $95 billion Senate bill to the House floor for a vote. $95 billion is fully 1% of the total U.S. defense budget. $95 billion out of $895 billion. No one in the Senate or House gets everything they want. It's called compromise. Where are the party whips? What happened to getting your conference in line? Damn the torpedoes. Bring the bill back to the floor for a vote. Our allies are looking at us like we are a second-rate country. If we don't help Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel, our friends, our country is getting a very thin ice. Turn away from the extremists. The country is watching, which is a statement you have made a few times already today.
Well, one of the things I wonder about is the speaking of the House leadership, where is Congresswoman Elise Stefanik in all of this? She represents a pretty extensive, you know, her constituencies are a lot of military bases.
She's grilling college presidents.
I understand that.
Yes.
Thank you. That was interesting yesterday, her. Not necessarily in a good way. But The letter writer is correct, and where is the Republican leadership? Where is she on this issue of maintaining the U.S. strength, doing what's right for the U.S., doing what's right on a global perspective? Given her various roles on committees and her leadership position, she should know better. But again, I think where she is on the phone with Donald Trump, and this is a time where we need real leadership. The world's on fire. They need to move, send some stronger signals about the U.S. role in the world.
You know, if you think who's left in the Republican Party, people who couldn't stomach answering all the questions and dancing around the Donald Trump questions are gone, and more of them are leaving by the day. I just think there are so many people now who are Republicans who, you know, imagine having, if you're a real thinking person, having to stand up and defend January 6th. I get that there might be some people in the world who are true pacifists and isolationists. But I might sort of respect, in some sense, the fundamental view, but I don't respect these people who hold this position because they want to stay away from Trump's wrath and they know what's better. And also, think about, you know, Mitt Romney said something interesting in his book, that he spends over $5,000 a month of his own money for security for his family and himself. And by the way, Mitt Romney's house, you know, he doesn't live like in an apartment with, you know, neighbors down the hall above and below.
Right.
So, Mitt, I mean, if that guy needs to spend that kind of money, it shows you the tremendous pressure that, unfortunately, the Republicans are under, and even more sadly, that so many of them cave to on a daily basis. It's repugnant.
But I think a lot of the House members, House Republican members, are thoughtful. And I think I had listened to some of the hearings on the Appropriations Committee folks, and some of them, I mean, the Republican budget, you look at the Republican Study Group budget, it's abominable. But again, that has a lot of influence of Trump in it. But those voices don't come forward. You don't hear them. They aren't showcased. Certainly not on Fox News, because if you listen to Fox News, it's all the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Tom Cottons and the those folks whose voices get amplified. And that's part of the problem right now. I think the reasonable portion of the Republican conference is those voices are not being amplified, and they need to speak up more. And in their silence, they become enablers. And I do think that they do need to, what are they, the Common Sense Caucus, or what, that's not what they call themselves. What is it? The Freedom Caucus is the far right.
The No Label Party?
No, there's a caucus of some House Republicans and Democrats who come together to try to the Solutions Caucus or something.
But well, we'll figure that out during the break. In the meantime, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It is the 18th of April, and we do welcome you and thank you for being with us. We are discussing what is happening as far as Speaker Johnson moving ahead with an aid package, and that is making some Republicans, especially far-right Republicans, very upset, and they are speaking out. And the question is, where does it go from here? And where does, you know, is this something that can end the speakership of Mike Johnson? Although yesterday on the panel, it was sort of assumed that if they needed 11 Democratic votes for it to pass, Hakeem Jeffries would say, okay. If you need 13 votes, he'd say okay. In other words, it behooves them to keep this guy as the speaker.
I presume that if they call a question, they'll see how many Republican votes, and then they'll give them the Democrats that they need to keep him as speaker. I don't think it makes sense for the Democrats to go through that again. There's too much important stuff that needs to happen. And also, Johnson seems to be understanding in the midst of all of it, in the end, he needs to get stuff done, right? In the end, he got it's been slow and painful, but in the end, he finally got the budgets passed months and months late, but got them passed. Don't you think?
I don't think you sent Nancy Pelosi out on the press, CNN last night, complimenting this procedural move by Johnson, unless you've lined it up to work with the Democrats providing whatever he needs. It would be a bit of a asking him to lean into a left hook if you do something different.
And I presume, like the appropriations, that this Johnson's working this out with the Biden administration folks, with the budget director and others that he seems to have developed a working relationship. I assume Steve Ricchetti, who's the legislative guy in the White House, has been at this forever. I assume that the longtime Biden people who all come out of the House and Senate are working these details out with him.
Can I ask Teresa you one question? I didn't understand. They're going to, presumably when these all pass, the plan is to take them and then to wrap them up into one bill so the Senate can't pick it apart. The Senate gets an up or down. Can you shed any light on exactly what they're – I know this is unfair because I'm putting you on the spot, but can you shed any light on what that is? No news outlet I've read has adequately explained what they're doing. And is it a procedural – that's something they can do procedurally without a vote on the floor?
Well, I think they pass individual bills, and then they bundle them, and then they have to pass a bill. So they'll pass everything individually, like you might pass individual appropriations bills. And then you put them in a package. It'll have its own name, its own number, and then it goes over it as a complete bill. That might be because they don't pick it apart, but it also might be because McConnell, I would guess, doesn't want to have to deal with individual votes on the Senate side with his Republicans, and he's probably on the phone saying, do not send me individual bills. Do not force my members to vote on an individual Ukraine bill and individual Israel bill. So I assume that that's but what they do is they pass 4, 5, 6, whatever it's going to be, because now there's the TikTok bill. So they pass them all individually, package them together, give it a name and a number, vote up or down on that, send it over to the Senate.
All right. Let's go to this letter from Roger, who says it's beyond reprehensible that Green and a small number of House Republicans are threatening the Speaker for attempting to govern, something that seems well beyond the ability of the current Republican Party. Then Mark writes and says the Republicans are opposing the aid for Ukraine because Trump wants to punish Ukraine for not helping him with an investigation of Biden. Trump is acting as a shadow president in matters of foreign affairs.
If only they would come out and say that directly.
I think Biden's main reservation is giving Trump's main reservation is giving Biden a win. If he can stick it in the side to Zelensky while he's doing it, that probably is a small win for him too, but I don't think that's his driving issue.
But also his connections are not with Putin, right?
Right. He's got some peculiar connections with Russia that, you know, it's funny. Alan Chartok always used to sit and say there's just something we don't all know. And I was a little bit of a skeptic of that somewhat conspiratorial view. I am no longer a skeptic of that view. There's something going on there.
And I was thinking last night about when I was reading, imagine Putin just sitting there smiling right now at all of this. And I wish some of the Republican leadership would be thinking about that more carefully, and thinking about who are our allies and who are our adversaries. And let's vote with our allies.
I have to believe that when Marjorie Taylor Greene repeats some of these conspiracy theories about the Ukraine, about the Nazis and the priests, And on this show before, Vera Karius-Kelly has gone into great detail as to explaining that, you know, most good conspiracies contain some nugget of reality in them, but they go – obviously they're conspiracies because they go far beyond. But having acknowledged that, every time Marjorie Taylor Greene repeats those, I got to imagine that somebody in the misinformation ministry in Russia runs into Putin's office and slides a piece of paper across that great white table, and they all have a great laugh over it.
Like, it's working. It's working. Yeah.
You know, I worry on Ukraine that it may be too little too late at this point. Russia is advancing. We hear reports from the field that they're out of ammunition. You know, I know it's to Ukraine's benefit for them to present to the world a posture that they, you know, that they're still strong, that they're fighting back. But it's been many months when they their ammunition levels have been low, their air defenses have been hit hard. I worry about that. The quicker they can act, the better. But it may be that Trump sees the handwriting on the wall and say, you know what, it's a lost cause. Let them spend some money on it.
It's not a lost cause. No. I agree that we've done damage, probably irreparable damage. But as long as there are people interested in the value of liberty who are willing to take up arms in that conflict, we as the United States should be providing them what we can.
Oh, I agree. But there's the reality from the battlefield. And again, there's been so much focus on Israel and Gaza that we haven't gotten a lot of news out of Ukraine in the last, I don't know, 6 weeks, except the fact that they're running out of bullets.
But the bombings, the Russian bombings continue. They continue to hit hospitals. They continue to hit. They hit a school yesterday, I think it was, maybe the day before. They're all blurred. But I think that, again, yesterday's testimony by the head of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense, it was grim and urgent, but still very necessary. So I think that it's not money wasted. And I think we have a clear understanding. Trump is giving us a clear understanding of what pathway you want to choose. Do you want to choose the Biden administration pathway that wants to build the alliance, strengthen NATO, and support Ukraine? Or do you want to choose the Biden pathway that I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is leading us down, which is abandoning Ukraine?
Pardon, you mean the Trump? I do that
Trump.
All the time. You mean
Did I say Trump? Yeah. I'm sorry. The Trump pathway that Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think, is the spokesperson for.
One or two more letters, then we'll take a break. Spencer writes, how long should we continue to fight for, quote, American values in the Ukraine? Another 3, 5, or maybe 10 years? Is there possibly a way we can fight for American values without affecting the slaughter of human beings? That from Spencer. And finally, we go to...
Spencer's right. It's going to take a while under the best of circumstances. We're not going to tip this conflict until well into next year. But his answer is we should fight for those values so long as there are people willing to help us fight for those values.
We will take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other subjects. Our panel is raring to go. We will work with them, and we'll work with you as well. All you have to do is write to us, panel@WAMC. We'll work with anybody. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. Teresa Bourgeois is here, Judy Patrick, and Mark Whitman. We welcome you, panel@WAMC.org. All right, let's go to another topic and move on this morning. The other big story out yesterday was the impeachment attempt against Mayorkas. This was an interesting story because I think as early as yesterday they were saying that they didn't know how the Senate was going to go on this. But the Senate voted Wednesday to dismiss two articles of impeachment against the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, which allege he mismanaged an influx of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. Both votes were along party lines. The impeachment trial came to a close a little more after 3 hours after it started, following a GOP senator's move to quickly quash an offer for limited debate and the creation of an impeachment committee, marking a rapid close to the first impeachment of a sitting cabinet secretary. A spokesperson for Mayorkas has released a statement highlighting the dismissal of the charges as further indication that there was no evidence or constitutional grounds to justify impeachment. Senators voting 51 to 48 found the first article charging Mayorkas with willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law to be unconstitutional. Senator Lisa Murkowski voted present. Senators voted again along party lines, 51 to 49, to find the second article charging Mayorkas with breach of public trust also to be unconstitutional. This time, Murkowski sided with her party. The trial came to a conclusion before the House impeachment managers could present their arguments. Teresa.
So I think that the Republicans are saying this is a very dangerous precedent to not go ahead with the impeachment trial. But I concur with Senator Schumer that it would be a very dangerous precedent to say that you could impeach somebody for policy differences. But looking at the bigger picture of what the issues are here, tomorrow is the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, that one of the worst acts of terrorism in U.S. history up until 9/11. 168 people were killed. More than 500 people were injured. Initially thought to be foreign actors. In fact, it was U.S. Terrorism, right?
Timothy McVeigh.
And I bring that up because I think that these Republicans need to take a, you know, a step back and think about the consequences of their actions or inactions, where they put their time, where they put their focus, the politicization of what's happening and not happening at the border. There is mutual concern about the border. There was a bipartisan agreement about a way to fix the border that some say was unprecedented. It had the strong endorsement of one of the most conservative Senate Republicans, Senator Lankford, who happens to be from Oklahoma. And yet the Republicans, again, with because of signaling from Donald Trump, did not take that deal, did not take that win. And that bill would have helped to address many of the issues and concerns about what's going on at the border. And the Republicans keep talking about how they're all for law and order, they're all for public safety. If you watch Fox News, it's all about scaring people about what's going on. But in fact, you know, as they say, don't tell me what you value, show me your budget and I'll tell you what you value. And if you look at the Republican budgets last year and this year proposed to cut cops funding. That's funding to put more police on the streets locally. They proposed to cut deeply into the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, the people who regulate guns. Guns are one of the leading killers of young people in this country. They proposed to cut funding for a range of programs, like programs to deal with domestic violence. They want to cut deeply into funds that will fund prosecutors. It would reduce the number of prosecutors here. So when it comes to really supporting law and order, to really supporting public safety, the Republicans have a lot of rhetoric, but they don't back that up with funding. And I think that this was performative. I think it's dangerous. I think it's distracting. And I think we have to pause and reflect on what happens in this country when you foment violence. And what happens is a guy on the far right blows up the side of a building and he kills enormous number of people, including young children in a daycare center. That's what happens when it gets out of hand. And so people like Carrie Lake, who yesterday were urging people to, you know, strap on your guns, and people like Sean Hannity, who's stoking hatred and division, and people like Tom Cotton, who's urging people to forcibly remove protesters, and people like Donald Trump. We've got to stop fomenting violence in this country, and we've got to get to working on some of these key issues. And we need to remember what happens when, you know, when you blow up the side of a building.
Mark?
Well, the last time we impeached a member of the administration, it was Ulysses S. Grant, Secretary of War, who
wait a minute, didn't he win?
Who was basically taking bribes. Yeah, but if you remember, Grant had tremendous trouble sort of managing his administration, probably because he was too good of a guy. But look, if you look at the charges, they're extraordinarily flimsy. You know, there was the one part of the complaint, if you look at it, says that Mayorkas acted in contravention of a lower court ruling in removing the Remain in Mexico requirement that Trump had installed. The articles of impeachment failed to mention that the Supreme Court said that he should that it was okay. They cleared him on it. You know, also the complaint is full of evidence that Mayorkas wasn't doing the right thing because of the statistics showing the action of the border security authority. For instance, they say, well, they're catching so much fentanyl coming across the border, and they're deporting so many migrants. Well, of course, there's a problem. These were not grounds for impeachment. These are simply Republican attempt to highlight their disagreements over the border, which you have to admit is a mess. I was disappointed that the vote in the Senate went down entirely on party lines with...
Almost entirely.
There was one exception. Markowski didn't vote for...
She voted present.
Present for one of the two articles. But Romney went with both of them, which, again, I just think emphasizes how sad a state of affairs it is within the Republican Party. I usually use... You know, I usually, if Romney's not on board with something, I usually give it a second thought, but I don't think these charges merited, frankly, a second thought. And for maybe one of the very few times in this program, I'm going to congratulate Chuck Schumer. I think what he did with a little parliamentary leisure domain yesterday to get these things excused as quickly as possible was the right move.
Right. This impeachment was doomed from the start. Chuck Schumer shut it down quickly, and the Democrats shut it down quickly. Let's call this what it is. It was just a move by the Republicans to continue to criticize the Biden administration on their border policy. And it was effective in that way. It came to such a quick conclusion for all the months we talked about this. It was stunning in that respect. What I wonder now is impeachment going to continue to be used as a device to get a controversial issue out in the public sphere? Or will people have come to their senses and realized impeachment is a tool that should be used selectively? I fear that the former rather than the latter will happen.
But it was performative. And at what point are they going to be held accountable for not actually working on the issue? Imagine if all the time and money and resources that they spent on this in the House was spent on working toward a solution. And they need to be held accountable for not voting on options to address the problem when they had a bipartisan bill before them that they could have done that. And they talk about fentanyl. Well, provisions in the bill would provide more of the right tracing equipment, as I understand it. Most of the fentanyl comes over the bridge. You know, it comes through the vehicles, right? And there are machines which they have been begging for more of them. They talk about the backlog of, you know, stopping people at the border. Well, first of all, the Trump administration defunded the mechanisms around the world where you come in and country by country and come in properly. So they want to rebuild that. Biden administration hasn't been able to get the funds to do that through the Republican Congress. And they also want more people at the border. The bill provided more people at the border to process so that free up the Border Patrol who are doing jobs that aren't their jobs. So there are solutions. There are steps that could have been taken, and these Republicans need to be held accountable for not taking the steps to solve the problem.
Well, a failed impeachment effort has enabled Democrats to make those very points, and I think they're doing an effective job of doing it. And when that bill was proposed and when it failed, I think some smarter than other Republicans realized that. But they had gone down the impeachment road too far and had to pursue it.
Before we leave this, I think Alejandro Mayorkas, I have a lot of respect for him. If you listen to one of his news conferences, actually, he's pretty adroit. I do think he should get a citation for speeding. He did proffer an answer to a congressional committee that was at best deceptive. If you look at, he was asked about the security of the border, and more specifically, is the border secure? And that in legislation has a definitional meaning. And he kind of knew better than the answer he proffered because he was afraid what it would look like in sound bites. I think, you know, if there were a way to give somebody a speeding ticket, he probably should have gotten one for that answer. But that's not to say that it merits any of these shenanigans, frankly.
Right. And that's not what they use that, but that's not really what this was about.
No.
This was political, very costly political theater. It costs it's a hazard to the, it puts the Border Patrol at risk because they don't have enough Border Patrol agents, right? They are in action. It puts people at risk who are crossing in ways that they shouldn't. I mean, it's very costly all around the country because the system is not being managed properly, and there are steps that can be taken not to solve it all. There's not a comprehensive immigration plan, but there was some agreement on ways to address the problems immediately at the border that could have been taken. And they didn't want to take those steps because Trump didn't want to give the Biden administration the win. And so lots of folks are suffering for that, and it's very costly to the country.
We have letters, and I want to get to a few of them before we move on to other subjects. Some of them are from previous things that we discussed this morning. We begin with, perhaps it's time for a new acronym, American in name only, A-I-N-O, to identify those who would conflate nationalism and patriotism while aiding and abetting our adversary, suppressing the rights of certain citizens to vote and dismantling the First Amendment. Then we go to Michael. It is obvious that Trump will use the ploy of gag order violations as a way of endangering judicial response for the purpose of delay, delay, delay. And yeah. Don't forget the fundraising aspect, but yes.
Yeah, I really, as I was talking about earlier, I am very concerned about the fomenting, you know, the danger that a range of people are under, the danger that prosecutors are under, the danger that judges are under, the dangers that poll workers are under, and now the danger that jurors may be under. And this has escalated, and it's an active effort, and I think it's destabilizing our courts, it's destabilizing our election system. And Trump is who he is, but this is allowed to continue because the enablers, the people who know better around him and who will remain silent, are not speaking up against this. And people are going to get hurt. It needs to stop. I mean, Fannie Willis in Atlanta, the fact that she cannot live in her own home because so much hate has been fomented against her that for the last 2 years she has to move every couple months from house to house is just outrageous.
Yeah, just this morning, one of the jurors who was seated on the Trump trial was excused after she expressed concern that elements of her identity had become public. This comes after Jesse Waters, the Fox News host, had a segment and he posted something that says, "She says no one is above the law. I'm not so sure about her." Guess who reposted that on Truth Social? The defendant, Donald Trump. And so the judge says, "No, you can go." Expect this kind of attack to continue. Did Trump violate the gag order by reposting it? Maybe that will be included in the discussion they have next week about whether or not he's violating the gag orders.
The answer is yes. He violated the gag order. It's pretty clear. I'm disappointed in the judiciary and all this, and I'll tell you why. The Trump early on was making disparaging comments about the judge's daughter, and the judge in this case, whose name escapes me, decided on his own or in consultation with his daughter that his daughter could take it. And he let it go for a while. And then finally, he put a stop to it. He should have put a stop to it day one because it doesn't matter if his daughter can take it. I don't want every other judge's daughter, son, or offspring to be in the line of Trump's fire. And I would suggest, I'm sure the guy's listening on breaks to this show, you know, I'd suggest you get this judge a panel of three senior judges whom everyone respects, and every time we're worrying about what should we do about Trump, you simply ask the three of them in consultation with Mershon, if this were a normal defendant, what would we do? And whatever the answer is, particularly if it's unanimous. My point is, I think to ask one judge to make all these decisions and to stand up for them is obviously too much because the guy equivocated for a while on whether or not to protect his daughter. And I wish there were a mechanism to afford this guy a little bit more support so that he goes into a room and says, "Hey, if it wasn't Donald Trump, what would we do?" And comes out of the room and slaps down whatever it is or isn't without respect to whether or not this guy's the president or former president, because we're clearly giving him far too wide of a berth. And you can already see it's having an effect on what's going on in the courtroom. And that's the judiciary's fault.
And it seems that he's trying to provoke, right? He's trying to test the limits, that retweeting last night, because they say legally it wasn't his writing, so maybe it wasn't that. I'm saying the Fox News assessment of the situation, right? But that's crazy.
Yeah, I suggest not to look to Fox News for arbitration as to what's true in the world and what's not.
But I think the reason I've been trying to watch Fox News more and more and listen to conservative radio is to have a better understanding of why, when I talk to people, why they're saying what they're saying, why they're fearful in ways that are astounding to me. You know, the people, I hear it from a couple of different places. Oh, I'm afraid to go here. I'm afraid to go there. And then once you start watching Fox News and you hear these things repeated over and over again, they take one. First, crime is down, but if you watch Fox News, it's mayhem, right? And it's dangerous to go anywhere. And all women are going to get punched in the face. And anyways, I digress. But I do. This having jurors fearing for their life and their safety if they get exposed. I mean, you were talking earlier about members of Congress who, as Mitt Romney talks about, how much he's paying in security. And some members of Congress will say privately that they're concerned about voting a certain way because they don't have the money to protect themselves and their families. And now it's going to happen with jurors. I mean, that's just...
Hey, also, Donald Trump had his phone out this morning in the courtroom, and that's against the rules. And he finally put it away when his lawyer said, put the phone away. And it's like I have a feeling that this is going to come back to bite him because the jurors are there. They got, you know, they're there. They respect the court. They got dressed up. They're, you know, normal people. They respect the process. And if they see him flouting too many rules, even though they're not supposed to be on social media, if they see his disdain for what's happening become too evident, I think it will work against him in some respects when it comes to when the jury makes their decision.
And by comparison, President Biden is in Pennsylvania talking about taxes. And
doesn't he know
unions.
There's other states besides Pennsylvania? He always
really
goes to
Pennsylvania.
I know, but I'm a state too.
No, I know, it's his home state. It's where he grew up.
Oh, so it's all about politics.
Yeah.
He's campaigning 3 stops this week in Pennsylvania, talking about taxes and funding, you know, the dangers of the continuing the Trump tax, which Mark knows much more about this than I, but making investments in the middle class as opposed to giving tax breaks to and increasing our
I'm just
deficit.
Feeling overlooked or disregarded. Come on up to New York once in a while.
You got
to
move if you want to get
he's in New York
presidential love. unless you're a big donor and you can make one of those Manhattan events,
or if you're
you got to move.
If you're a bodega near the
in Harlem, yeah,
on the way from the courthouse to wherever fundraiser he's going to after the days of trial. Go ahead, Joe. Sorry, letters.
No worries. Oliver says Judy's statement that Israel needs funding is ludicrous. Regardless of whether or not one champions Israel, a well-off country more than capable of funding its own little war, just how many bombs does Israel actually need if Israel doesn't bath Gaza in ordnance like there was a fire sale on weapons of destruction? If instead Israel applied only judicious application of deadly force, we wouldn't need to reward them with even more bombs and missiles to squander.
I don't know if I said that. I'm a strong supporter for Ukraine funding. I think we historically have supported Israel's and Israel's right to be safe and protect itself. So, but at this point, I really want Ukrainian funding to go through.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you. We have many more topics to discuss with our panel. We have Teresa Bourgeois, Mark Whitman, and Judy Patrick. We'll be back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Teresa Bourgeois, Judy Patrick, for God's sakes, Judy Patrick and Mark Whitman, thank you all for being with us. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let's go to another topic and one that we were talking about during. We have two things I want to discuss before we go away this morning. And one is I think the last time on Tuesday, Judy was with us and we were talking about the NPR editor, Yuri Berliner, who worked at NPR for 25 years and said in an essay last week that the nonprofit has allowed a progressive bias to taint the product. And so there was quite the uproar over the writing, and there was a Substack piece that he did. And there was it made the rounds everywhere, and obviously a lot of people in public radio were very upset and caught off guard by it, and also obviously conservatives who have been, you know, had a bullseye on NPR for decades, thought that they, you know, it was Christmas morning. So now you'll remember that he was put on leave for 5 days. 5 days leave, and the what he did that was against the rules was there is a policy in place at NPR that no one speaks out of turn. You go to your superiors, you tell them what you're going to be writing, or if anyone asks you questions, and then you report that, and then they allow it, and it goes on. Well, he didn't do any of that, obviously, and so that's what they used as the reason for suspension. Then yesterday he resigned. He resigned and said enough. And he had worked at the network for 25 years, and finally said in a social media post Wednesday that he was resigning because of criticism from the network's chief executive, Catherine Marr. I cannot work in a newsroom where I'm disparaged by a new CEO whose divisive views confirm the very problem in NPR I cite in my free press essay. Then a whole bunch of folks within NPR, I believe at least 50, wrote a letter to the head of NPR and said that they wanted to find out how all of this happened, find out where exactly the rules are here and what we can do to improve the situation. I think it's safe to say the network is in a great deal of turmoil. I would also say as a person who has been in the periphery of NPR for many years, you know, they're always in some sort of turmoil. I think that's safe to say. But this yet again is a image issue that is going to be hard to, you know, it's going to stay around for a while. Mark.
Well, my first reaction when I actually read the Substack criticism, you know, was a little bit like the Claude Rains character when he walks into Rick's casino in Casablanca and he declares that he's shocked to find gambling here. The fact that NPR is liberal. I mean, the good news about it, NPR, in my view, and I've been a longtime listener, is that it is very liberal, but it's also very accurate and very truthful. So I think it's one of the publications where the lens that you need to hold up in front of it is probably thinner than most, in that there's a political bent to what you're seeing, but it's probably accurate and there's probably the truth. I thought some of the criticisms in the letter were legitimate. I think it's great that NPR will probably now have to do a little soul searching. I think too much has been made of it, frankly. And I'll give you a good analogy that I've seen in business. If you think about enterprises like McDonald's that sort of have a corporate head and then lots of franchise operations, when the corporate has problems, it's magnified by the fact that all these franchisees hue and cry and say, well, you're affecting my hometown business too. So it underscores, I think both the importance of getting it right at the corporate level, but also the fact that when you see this normal give and take and pendulum swing in terms of what organizations focus on and don't focus on, it seems to get amplified in the context of NPR, and maybe in a way unfairly so. Look, when I turn on Fox News, I think Fox News is 100% accurate because I get exactly what I expect, which is a version of the truth that's been distorted by their conservative view. And so when I turn it on, I get exactly what I expect. I don't get truthful depictions of the truth, but I get what Fox News has distorted, and that's exactly what I expect when I turn them on. When I turn on NPR, I know I'm getting a series of stories that were selected by a organization with a liberal bias, but I also know I'm getting very accurate and very truthful stories once that selection's been made.
Judy.
Well, any media organization, large and small, but especially large organizations, are going to be criticized. NPR has been criticized for decades. We've talked in the past about the fact that it's a management employee issue in one respect, in the fact that if there's a rule that you're not supposed to go out and write for other organizations, you shouldn't do that. Also, if you have a problem with what we're doing in terms of editorial decision making, you bring it to the appropriate resources or appropriate supervisors, talk about it, hash it out. And then if you're going to write something about us bad, you're at least going to get our comment. He resigned. He's become kind of a martyr. I would advise anybody, I think it's true, NPR might lean left, but just listen to it. Like right now, there's a story on their website that says states botch morgue executions of black prisoners. Experts think they know why. Is that a story that has a liberal bent to it? Conservatives might say yes. I would say no, that's not a biased story. That's a legitimate story that needs to be pursued. And kudos to them for that investigation. I think you need to listen and make the decision for yourself. The one thing I've noticed from NPR in the last a couple of years is that they've tried to diversify away from hard news. Some of their morning and evening newscasts tend to have more artsy kind of stories or more stories about a new album dropping than I'm used to seeing. And that's probably an effort to appeal to younger voter or younger listeners, and that's a good thing in terms of the long-term livelihood of NPR.
Teresa.
So, while important, I don't really understand a lot of the internal machinations about what they are and aren't allowed to do and what line he did or did not cross. But I do take exception, Mark, with the notion that I'm stuck on that about Fox News being quote unquote accurate, or I wouldn't put them on parallel with NPR in the sense that I don't think that, maybe if you look at the narrow scope of their newscast, such as it is, but they are so predominantly focused now on conveying a core message and not presenting balanced news stories. There's very, very little there presenting balanced news stories. And I think NPR, just like the PBS NewsHour, is much different than MSNBC, right? It's a place you can go for a broader range of stories. They're more in-depth. They are fact-based. And I'm not saying they aren't without bias, but they are much more fulsome reporting, right? The series they're doing now on guns, for instance, this last week. Now, you might say that's biased because they're talking about the issues that they're talking about, but in fact, those are the facts. The facts are that there's a group of young people, the majority, the greatest deaths are of, I can't remember the age range, but of young people is death by gun, right? And but they conversely had a segment on gun safety and the kinds of things that the NRA used to do, which is teach gun safety and how that's important, right? So there's more balance there than you get either on MSNBC or Fox. But I would not equate Fox and NPR in any way.
Right. I think even there would be some people on the right who would argue that even NPR tackling the gun stories shows a bias, and that's just where they're coming from. Doing a story about a greater executions of black prisoners rather than white prisoners, people will argue, well, that shows bias, but it doesn't show bias. It shows the world as it is, and they're bringing what they perceive as a problem. And I think any normal person would say that doesn't seem right. That more black prisoners are executed than white prisoners, disproportionately. So I think anyone would think that's news.
It'll be interesting to see what happens going forward and how they come out of it, assuming they do. I'm sure they will. It's not that, I don't think it's that shocking to most people. And this is extremely anecdotal, 100% anecdotal. But of the people who have written us, most people are in support of NPR and say, yeah, but what about ... we haven't gotten all the letters that say, yeah, I knew all along you all were liberal snowflakes.
Yeah. But also, for a long time, we talked about the reason you want diverse people making decisions is because people come, they have story ideas, they go in certain directions based on their own experiences, right? And based on the background they bring to it are often the story ideas that get moved forward. So it speaks to the need for a more diverse group of people around a table making decisions about what stories to cover and that kind of thing. But I do think when they do cover stories, they are more fact-based.
And even the examples he cited, I think, can be debated and have been debated whether or not the media properly handled the Hunter Biden laptop story. That was something everybody struggled with, except the New York Post, apparently. But, I mean, it took months for the New York Times, the Washington Post, to come to a better understanding of what that involved and how that should be played. So I don't fault NPR for that.
All right. Final story is on Caitlin. We only have, what do we have, about a minute? Probably didn't even have time for the story. I want to talk real quick about Caitlin Clark and the salary, because Judy brought it up earlier this week. She was shot out of a cannon. I said a good morning, and she said, "What about a Caitlin Clark," which was good. But we'll get to that another day. Maybe even tomorrow when we have all women panel, and I think that would be a great discussion.
Yes.
To have, if you want to be a part of that program, all you have to do is write to or go to WAMC.org, and just go to the donate button, and you'll see the tickets on the drop-down menu, $75, and you can join us, breakfast, see the whole crew, and it'll be quite a morning. Judy will be there. Judy, see you then. Mark, thanks as always. Really good to have you here. And Teresa Bourgeois, thank you.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.